You are listening to the Furla Bros Tech Podcast, episode 164, The Difficulty of Making Hard Decisions.
Episode 164 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is November the 16th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my half-marathoning brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, that is right. And I'll get rid of your echo for you. You're in Disneyland, right?
Well, not technically. I'm just off a
just off property.
Off property, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah, I am. But I'm right next door, because I was running a half marathon with her sister this morning. It's up at bright and early, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I bet. So what was your time?
3 hours and 37 minutes, you know.
Nice!
Walking.
Hey. It's cool, you know. It counts.
Yeah. It was, I was doing it with the sister, and so we kept her pace. You know, I might have tried to do it a little bit faster at a minute of my own, but at the same time, I've not trained for a half marathon actually, so it's probably a good thing I didn't try to do it faster, because I'm sure I would have been able to go faster for the first 6 miles, and then I might.
And then you're headed back into the park this afternoon, right?
I'm actually not. I was planning on doing the podcast at like 9 o'clock. So,
yeah.
No, it's all right. And I honestly, it's better this way. I enjoy Disneyland, but I don't know if
you enjoy tech even more. I gotcha.
Well,
I gotcha.
Yeah, and just in general, it's like one day is good enough for me, and you know, I'm good. I'm satiated, so I'm more than happy to be on the road, going home. We'll probably go downtown Disney, get some pizza for
that's a
lunch,
good idea.
That sort of thing.
Oh, that sounds maybe so good right now.
Right? And I feel like I can justify it because I just did a half marathon. Yes!
Awesome, so, man.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. You know.
I'm going to San Diego this afternoon. Or tonight.
Yeah.
Yep, going there for work. Going to spend a couple days. I will work super, super hard. It's going to be good.
You are going to work super, super hard?
I am, yeah. And I'm not just like saying it ironically. I will probably work harder than I normally do.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
That's
considering the fact that it's like one of the few times of the year you'll be able to see sun.
We're just going to ignore that comment and we're going to move on.
Fair enough. So, man, unfortunately, it is going to be a little bit of a short show, so I guess I'll move us right along through the preliminaries quickly, so that this week, like every week, we can be talking about technology and, quote, the continuing corporate opera, and by that we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology that they're developing. And then, like normal, before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure that he's got to throw our way.
I work for Hewlett-Packard. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
That is good to know. That doesn't affect anything this week, does it?
Yeah, it'll affect us on the first story.
Okay. Okay. I was reading. So, we do all sorts of stuff throughout the week if you want to follow us. Like, I've been posting pictures. Doing the half marathon prep, aka riding rides in Disneyland, or you know, completing it, showing off my Avengers medal. Oh baby, stuff like that.
It's so good to be Disney,
right? It's right. It's so funny, dude. So this is on topic. So I'll do it right now. But because I forgot to do it earlier. But we were going through my favorite super. Is his superhero?
Say that one more time.
I mean, my favorite superhero is Iron Man because what is his superpower? He's basically just really good at engineering.
Awesome, that's genius. Gotcha.
Yeah, and so I'm a big fan of that. So
makes sense.
I was very excited to get some Iron Man swag for to do the race in, and and you weren't able to buy anything here, and I was kind of confused by that, and then like I was looking around, and like Iron Man wasn't on any of like the promo stuff. He's not anywhere. Like, there's no Iron Man stuff. I was like, why the heck aren't they, like, they own Iron Man? He's an integral part of the Avengers on every level. Like, how can you not do Iron Man? And then all of a sudden, like, it clicked. That's because the Iron Man is already a major race relay, and they can't be, I'm sure they don't actually own the rights. Like, you know, they probably had Iron Man all over everything.
Oh, interesting.
The leader of the Avengers. I'm sure the Iron Man race sued them and said, you can't do that. yeah, I guess we can't. So it was funny. They were even poking fun at the fact that, like, during the, you know, they got the announcers yelling at everybody. Oh, nice Captain America costume, nice this costume, nice that costume. And then, like, as the Iron Man wearing ones would go by, they'd be like, nice Tony Stark costume. And they even like, one of the girls, like, almost slipped up once, and she's like, yeah, I really like the, I mean, oh, I'm not allowed to say that. That guy, I can't mention his costume. And it was, which actually made me feel pretty clever, because up to that point, it was just auspiciously missing, and nobody had pointed out the fact that they couldn't say it, and I was like, when she said that, I was like, oh, I totally called it, figured it out, feel very smart. Anyways,
interesting.
If you want to be able to check all that sort of stuff out throughout the week, we do have social media accounts. One way is at Matthew D. Furlow. That's my Twitter. The other is at NextWiggin4, and that's my Instagram, where I post all my photographs. And you can check out, as James described earlier, my gigantic beard, amongst other things.
It's true. I don't think I said that live. But you do have
that's right.
Ginormous beard, and it's true. Well, you should check it out. And I'm just James Furlow everywhere.
Nice. Yeah. You always keep it early, easy. And then if you want to get more about the show, we got a site for that too, furloughbros.com. Throughout the episode, we got all sorts of articles that we're referencing. Maybe we got videos or audio clips, whatever, stuff like that. If you want to know more, you want to contest what we're saying, or you just are generally interested, and you can go check out our website. There we post all the articles that we talk about throughout the show. We also put a link to the podcast and a link to the YouTube. So no matter what direction you're coming at, in order to find the content, it is there. That is where all roads intersect. And, you know, we don't really care what road you try. You know, you want to take the road less travel, let that make all the difference, that's cool. Go for it. We're down. Whatevskis. But, yeah.
All right. This isn't exactly the road less traveled. It seems to be the road that's more traveled nowadays. There's a new hardware company out there, and they've got a Kickstarter campaign going on.
Yeah.
That's the Flux 3D printer. Heard of it?
Yeah.
You want one?
I do want a 3D printer, yes.
Do I want this 3D printer?
What is the Flux? I don't really know anything about it.
So if you do it now, it's only $500. But if you wait till after the Kickstarter, it's going to be $600. It's a combination. It's a 3D printer, a 3D scanner, a ladder. It's an engraver thing.
Wow.
And then for that printer, it prints either ceramics or pastry, apparently.
All right.
And then they're going to have some other models that you could buy as separate add-ons as well. So the idea is this thing where you can, they got a cool video, it's worth watching. It's all modular pieces, so you can exchange them. So one of the things you can do is you can put, if you lift off the cover, there's like a rotating surface, you could put an object on it. It has like a laser thing. It'll rotate and 3D scan the object, and then it goes into the software, which, from what I understand, it's all, you know, like iOS
Automagic
software. No, so it's like you can do it all on your phone type thing. It's kind of what it looks like. I'm sure you can import from other stuff too, and they're talking about they got an SDK for it. And then you could then print whatever it was that you scanned in. over and over and over again.
Nice.
Pretty sweet little thing. I don't know how long it takes. It probably takes forever, you know.
Yeah.
How they show it with the videos. Like, oh, and look, it's instantly done. Like, 7 hours later. But pretty cool. I mean, they make it sound like, you know, 20 minutes out of the box and you're up and running. You know, very much a cool little deal, man.
That is very cool. I read a little bit about that. One of the big reasons why I wouldn't want to invest in something like this, number one, at any like big cost hardware type thing, generally speaking, like they're, you know, especially if they're saying that they're going to sell for $600, what this is a company is basically raising enough capital to get like 2/3 of the way to actually shipping all those products. And then what they're doing is as soon as they get done with the Kickstarter campaign, they've raised money, they've started the work, and they've gauged enthusiasm, then they'll go to VCs and actually get enough money to do the rest. And personally, you know, I don't know about your $500 and what you got lying around in the bank, but I'd be much happier waiting and spending an extra $100 on a product that I know I'll get because it's a full-fledged company as opposed to, you know, an idea. But more importantly, and this is, I unfortunately don't actually have the article, I saw they're going to be doing an Indiegogo, but it's another 3D printer. But their whole thing is they do kind of the powder, layered powder, like the HP printers do, where they lay right. in a powder, and then they just hit the one layer at a time and build it up. But these guys are using nylon and a laser, and they're laser sintering together the nylon, which is similar to what the metal printers do, where they basically heat up the plastic, and so they build it up. As a result, it's actually a continuous piece of plastic that you're making, and so they're really, really rugged, and they're really flexible. So they were picking up like 20. They printed out a chain, and they were using the chain to lift up like 20-pound, like 30-pound weights with this like really thin chain, and it was actually really impressive from a strength perspective, and it was, you know, flexible and stuff like, you know.
Wait, so that's what these guys do?
That's what this other company was doing.
Oh, the other company.
That's the sort of 3D printer I'm like, I'm actually most excited about. Because those, to me, like, until you get to the, like, once you get to the laser-centered 3D printers at, like, scale and consumable, at a consumer level, even if they cost a few thousand dollars, you know, $2,000-$3,000, but consumers can actually buy 3D printers, like, that's going to be gigantic, especially because powderized metal is way easier to come by than you know, powderized plastics and stuff. So I feel like to me that's the direction you want to go is you know, that's going to be
okay.
Well, what am I saying?
I guess
I feel like if I'm going to
go ahead.
If I'm going to drop coin on a 3D printer, I want something that I think is a little more robust and rugged. And whereas the modular printer, I mean, like, it's cool. I like what they're doing. I just have a feeling that this thing's going to be doing way too much, and there's going to be compromises that are going to need to be made that are going to be rather frustrating.
Yeah, I got you. And I guess that's one of the things I like about it is the multifunction nature of it. Because it positions itself as a complete package. You know, you can scan stuff, yeah. You can print it, we've got the software for you to do it. You can even add your own hardware if you needed to. I like that. And honestly, like, it sounds like that other one's cool. But this is the kind of thing that's needed to take it out of the hardcore realm, the early adopter realm, people who are willing to figure it out, and move it into the, you know, a little bit more mass appeal group.
Yeah, I see that. I definitely see that.
Anyways, that's what I like about it.
Yeah. No, I like that. That is very cool. So, did you hear what happened this week?
I'm a follower of XKCD. So I was made aware of it the morning of.
Nice. Were you following the event live?
the comic was updating live. Is that what you mean?
That's, I guess that's fair. I mean, you know,
that was the extent.
So yeah, so this week we ended a 10-year trip where we effectively shot a bullet 10 years ago out into the depths of space, and tried to get this tiny little object to slingshot off of three different planets and then, or a planet, a celestial body, three different times, and then line up within a few hundred yards of a of a tiny little rock that was careening through space, and then once we had somehow managed to achieve that incredible feat, we then dropped a tiny little robot onto it, and oh man, and yeah, we landed on a friggin' comet earlier this week. Go humanity! Woo!
how do you pronounce that little rocket's name? Just Philae.
Philae. So I think something like that. I've heard.
I love that they're having some interactions with William Shatner. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's so dorky, man.
Dude, so as you know, I finished the Star Wars Clone Wars series, mm-hmm. Which was really good, by the way, and highly recommend it. And so I've started on the Star Trek series. So I'm in the middle of season one right now. I don't want to say it. I mean, it's just classic. It's just so classic. You know, the big boulders that are like almost bouncing because they're foam. It was great.
Yeah.
I watched this episode last night where Captain Kirk got into it was like a one-on-one battle with some other like lizard alien thing. And
I've seen that video.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Just like, yes.
After that fight, it's sort of amazing that they made it into their second season. But
you're just really strong beast, okay? You had to create a little makeshift cannon to kill him.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, so anyways, he's also a man in a puppet suit, and you want to know how I can tell? By watching it for 10 seconds.
yeah. Come on, the breathing was realistic. So all that to say, like, you know, I'm in the middle of watching that, and so, you know, that's kind of what's on my head. And, you know, then to have this go on, it's like, holy cow, man. That's like real space exploration.
We were all watching like Interstellar the other day and thinking like, "Oh, that'd be great to get on the planet." And then we actually managed to like do that this week. Yeah, it was huge. This is gigantic. I mean, it is getting that close to the comet was an astronomical like feat of engineering and planning and science, right? Jeez, feat of engineering and science. It's just incredible. And then to actually drop the probe and have the probe land. It's just awesome. The one problem that I heard, once it hit down, the harpoons didn't work. So it turns out you can't harpoon an asteroid, much to the chagrin of XKCD. Very excited about the prospect of being able to harpoon it like a whale. The harpoons didn't stick, but when it landed, because, you know, effectively the gravity is so much less that it has an effective gravity of or weight of about 1 gram on the surface of the asteroid. Wow. So it hit with, at 1 mile per hour, it hit with so much force that it actually bounced. And when it came back down, it hit with so much force again, it bounced again. Now, actually, it wasn't until its third touchdown that it finally came to rest. Underneath a cliff, was as best they can tell, and so it's only getting about 3 hours of sunlight a day. And the problem with that is that the batteries need about 8 hours.
Oh, that's bad.
To function properly. Yeah, it's really bad. So they think it's only going to last. I think today is, if they hadn't figured out what to do by today, they were going to run out of batteries and the thing would go dormant. There's a really good chance that once it gets to the sun, it'll the as asteroids are wont to do, they will start to explode at the surface. And one of the few somewhat accurate moments in Armageddon, as it starts to eject all of its different material and stuff. So that might cause it to tumble a bit and right itself if the surface of the asteroid becomes somewhat unstable. On the other hand, it is a object that weighs approximately a gram. So if any, you know, real erupting goes on, it could result in the thing just being flown and just, you know, chucked into space unceremoniously, without doing what to do. But they also said that, like, honestly, of the science that needs to be done, the lander was only responsible for about 20% of it. It's the satellite that's responsible for most of it, and that's working swimmingly. So there's not a concern that this wasn't... It's not like this wasn't a huge success with, you know, great, you know, victory for humanity, because it definitely was. It was just that, you know, from the perspective of the lander.
Yeah.
You know, not as... I mean, we successfully landed a functioning robot on the surface of an asteroid. You don't always do that right the first time, but, you know, it's not perfect.
Yeah, I've seen Armageddon. It doesn't always go to plan.
Exactly. Sometimes... It's such a stupid movie. I don't even want to go down that track. So I don't know. It's definitely interesting, though. I mean, it's like, it's fascinating. It's just, it's a great time. It's a great time to be alive. And hopefully, within a couple of months, we'll know more about asteroids and comets and meteors than we.
Yeah, I guess that was going to be my question. Like, what are we hoping to learn?
Basically, what they're made out of is one of the big things. These things are around from. The idea is that when planets form, when solar systems form, part of the formation process results in asteroids, and these asteroids just kind of get flung through space. But the thing is that, like, the sun and the Earth, they go through these processes that generate a tremendous amount of radiation and force, and you know, the sun has so much gravity that as it starts to generate fusing, the gravity literally fuses all the atoms together. That process releases a bunch of energy, which is what in turn makes it all hot, and in turn gets it hot enough to start breaking it apart, and fusion happens. And during that process, all these different molecules and radiation are being ejected and created. But right at the very beginning, like, there's this time chunk where sort of, like, they basically, the solar system took a piece, you know, took like a screenshot of the solar system way early on, and then threw it out into deep space so that it wouldn't be affected by the rest of the process. And so now that it's coming back around, we're going to be able to take a look at it and take samples of all the of everything on the surface and go, is there water? Are there organics? What's there that can help suggest, you know, what was created early on, what was prevalent everywhere versus what's incredibly rare, you know, because we think we know it's rare in the universe, in the solar system, but it's possible that some of the stuff that we thought was really rare is incredibly common. Like, it's possible that organic chemicals and types of proteins are incredibly common. They're just everywhere. They just naturally kind of happen. And it's just that, you know, in order for life to actually be sustained, they have to have a certain chemistry and a certain temperature. But just the building blocks, the things that we actually eat and sustain on, need to be, you know, are actually present everywhere, which would be great news, you know, if we want to pull an interstellar and try to colonize another planet. On the flip side, you know, it could be that it's just, you know,
sorry, say that again. It could just be what?
It could be that it's just barely more than hydrogen that's, you know, collected on the particular rock.
Well, it sounds like it's not very dense, so can't be too much.
Well, I'm gonna say, well, it's just not very big.
Right.
But so definitely exciting stuff to find out.
That is cool.
But there's more going on this planet, James.
Yeah, there is. There is. I don't know how we're going to do this, but I want to try.
Okay.
Because it is very much internet related, tech related. So I can do this. I can do this. Obama came out this week with a little statement.
Yeah, he did.
To save the internet. So essentially, all right, I gotta do this straight. So essentially, what he said. He came out in favor of net neutrality and, you know, was like, hey, look, we got to protect it. And, you know, and that's what we got to do. And, you know, it's one of those where I was reading this one article by M.G. Siegler that was talking about. He goes, politics is why we can't have nice things like the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's like, essentially what he said, he was like, it's like, yeah, we agree. The net should be neutral. Duh. You know, everyone should agree with that. And Obama says it, you know, the reason Obama gives is that it's the right thing to do. And it's one of those where it's like, I would like it to stay neutral. So, okay, I'm with you there.
Yeah.
He sits there and says, the problem though, this app is using features from a newer version of Google Talk. Whatever. Leave me alone. I'm in the middle of something. It says the reality is that this is something that he should have said, like, years ago.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting until a moment when he had nothing left to lose, and to where his party just, like, I can't repeat what he wrote here, lost big time. And so he was like, he's like, in some ways, this was just an easy win for me to, okay, I know I need to upgrade. Leave me alone. Oh, she's going to do it now? No. Can I close it? It's not even going to let me do that. Oh, whatever. Hopefully that, do you hear that beeping going on?
I don't hear anything, so.
Okay, good. Yeah. I'm not going to worry about it then. All right. So, they were like, it feels like he's going for an easy win. And they're like, but at the end of the day, it's like, this is really, really important. And so we're okay with him, you know, coming out and saying it. What's been really interesting about all of this though, and this gets into the opera side of the house, I think. And I'm just going to assume that everyone listening to this podcast knows what net neutrality is. It's the idea of, maybe I won't assume it. I'll just say it. You don't have fast lanes. You don't slow down other websites. You don't block certain websites. You don't, you know, give some premium access and others not, you know, that kind of thing. You don't say, you know, if you're going to take the free version, you can only use this search engine, which uses ads or something. I don't know.
For the record, and I think this is important to mention, is that part of the whole original definition of net neutrality, one of the big problems is there's no... I hate to advertise for other shows, but I was listening to my favorite morning talk show, The Armstrong Goodness Show, and they had on Leo Laporte, and he did a fantastic and succinct job describing the whole deal with net neutrality. And one of the things that's like important to remember is that early on, the part of the deal was not just that you would be unbiased in how data is transmitted, but also that the governing body would be kind of this loose collection of technologists as opposed to a single government, because it was viewed that a single government that controlled it would be as toxic to the process of, you know, internet communications as having, you know, not having net, you know, neutral transmission of data. So it was there was an urgency to leave the government out of it, as much as, you know, as much as it was to allow free flow of data.
Which is interesting.
It's very interesting because it's like, because I, you know, whatever my opinion on what is required, I think it's just worth, it's worth to mention both sides of the argument, and that there is an argument that, you know, to some people it's not simply obvious that, you know, well, we have to do something to do it. I mean, but anyways, continue.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. What you're saying, and I think it helps. I turned off my speakers and the beep is still happening. I don't know how this works. Maybe it's in my ear.
I can't hear it, but...
All right, must be my ear. It's pretty much every single time I talk, it dings at me.
It's annoying.
Very distracting. Okay, but I'm going to make it work. So anyway, so he came out and he said his deal. You know, we need to have this. What was interesting were the responses of people. I mean, there's three of them in particular that I'd like to highlight. The first one was from Tom Wheeler. He's the FCC chairman, the guy who's like actually...
I'm going to say, important opinion right here.
yeah, he's kind of important. He's the one actually making the rules. He comes out and is like, yes, President Obama, thank you for the input. We're independent, so we'll figure it out. Thanks.
Yeah.
Which are like, awesome. Go ahead.
Basically told Obama to mind his own business.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. Like, there were, again, this article, he was like, you know, he's kind of in a tough spot. It's like, it's lose-lose for him. He's like, if he supports the president's position, he's a White House stooge. If he opposes it, he's the fall guy.
Yep.
He's like, and it looks like he's ready to oppose it. I mean, given where he used to work and, you know, the fact that he was a big part of the telcos, you know, surprise, surprise, that he's willing to do that. So that was the first one. I was like, huh, okay, interesting. So this could still go anywhere, which at the end of his article, he's like, nothing's really going to happen out of this. It was just kind of, it was said, you know, it is what it is. But the positioning is super, super interesting. The other one were the Republicans and their statements. What a bunch of idiots. You know, it's like,
yeah,
if you don't fully understand something, just because your enemy says one thing, don't just go in the opposite direction, or at least be nuanced about it.
Yeah.
You know, I just like, we'll make fun of the big ones because they deserve it. John, what is it?
Boehner.
Boehner. I don't know. He goes, Republicans will continue our efforts to stop this misguided scheme to regulate hashtag the internet.
Which, by the way, he's the Speaker of the House. Another important, you know, opinion.
Well, because they were saying that essentially for what Obama wanted to have happen, like, it would require it going through the House and the Senate and him approving it. Because he's talking about something way beyond the FCC, really. And there's like, no, because you said it, no. Like, dude, the entire idea behind net neutrality is that it's not a regulation thing. I mean, you know what I mean? It's hard to describe, but it's like, we're making a regulation saying you can't mess with it, you know, but I don't know. Again, he put them in a hard place, you know, cause they're like, we don't want to agree with the guy, but we're also against regulation of any type, and yeah, it's tough. Who's the other one? It was Ted Cruz. Yeah, he was the one where everyone was like, really? Really?
Yeah.
He goes, net neutrality, in quotes, is Obamacare for the internet. The internet should not operate at the speed of government. Yes, thank you, Ted. We appreciate that. Just kind of like, good job, guys. Good job. And then the final one. And this is going to... I cannot believe I'm about to say what I'm about to say.
And another one for the record, Ted Cruz is a major presidential hopeful. So another... His opinion isn't super important, but it could be. It won't be. It's not going to win. It's not a problem. But
I'm gonna call it now. He's not going to be the next president.
No way.
It sounds like he says all sorts of crazy stuff, but that's just one where you look and go, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, well, and the deal, though, why it's important to remember is he will be on stage debating the guy who is going to be president and will be helping Republicans decide who they want to vote for. He'll be a major contributor to the conversation of who is the next Republican candidate. And,
sure.
You know, it's just worth remembering that the guy's not, you know, there's a ton of people in the House that are idiots but they're completely uninfluential. My rep is one of them. They don't do anything. They're not part of any committees. Nobody listens to them. They're just one more vote in the crowd. But Ted Cruz isn't just one more vote in the crowd. He's an opinion maker.
That's fair. Have no idea stupid, who Oregon's senators are, just for the record.
But fair enough.
That's more me just not caring. The last one, though, and this is going to sound crazy. Again, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I actually think I agree the most with. That's Comcast.
Really?
I know. Well, it's, you know, so everyone's coming out and like Comcast is all doublespeak, you know?
Oh yeah.
But the more I've started reading about it, and to be honest, I don't fully understand it. Cause again, I only care so much.
Yeah.
So they came out and were like, they came out with like a quick answer, and then they had kind of their longer one, and their longer one, you're like, oh, that actually sounds pretty reasonable. Other than I can't tell in some cases if they're lying or not. But anyways, they're like, yesterday the president outlined his plan for a free and open internet. Like, we totally agree. They go, what's remarkable is that if you compare the president's articulation of his vision for net neutrality as set forth by the White House, he goes, here's what he said. He says, we should have a free and open internet. We agree. That's our practice. No blocking. Yep. We agree, and we don't block anybody. No throttling. So I was like, they go, we agree, and that's our practice. I was like, okay, I think that's true. I don't know what the whole Netflix thing was. I think that's a blemish on that particular one. But, you know, all right, fine. They don't, for the most part, as far as I know, they don't throttle. I mean, believe me, I've downloaded some big things in my day, and they do not throttle. Legal, by the way. Just want to put that out there. increased transparency. I don't know fully what that means to them, but they say we agree and that's our practice. Okay. And then no paid prioritization. And again, they go, we agree, that's our practice. That was the whole Fastlane idea. And we kind of debunked that whole thing with Netflix again, where it wasn't that they were speeding them up, it was just they were hosting their content for them. You know, that's one of the things they do. And sure, it speeds things up, but not because they're getting special preferential treatment per se. It's just they got a better infrastructure. And so they're like, so fundamentally, like, we totally, completely agree with what the president is saying there. And I would kind of expect Comcast to say that. I don't have Verizon's remarks. I feel like Verizon would say something differently because they do the whole cell phone thing, whereas Comcast, again, is landlines and they've kind of played by it. Now, what they did say, though, where was it? Okay, so like, so A, we applaud him for saying that and we totally agree with the principles. He goes, but there's a technical legal difference in opinion that we have. They said, we do not support the reclassification of broadband as a telecommunications service under Title II. And so I was like, all right, I don't really know what Title II is, but I'm going to, you know, because I don't. But essentially what they're saying is, you turn it into a utility, which is like they have with the telecommunications lines. And so what they're, you know, you're saying everyone should have access. It's a thing. It's right up there with electricity and water, garbage, I guess. Less to an extent because that's different. But it's like electricity and water. You got to get hooked up to it. Everyone gets access. I suppose if you don't want to pay for it, you don't. That's more like garbage. And I guess, like, I have natural gas, and I could choose not to pay for that if I wanted to. But you're hooked up, and you could if you wanted to. And, you know, and it's especially important because of the costs involved to do that. You're not, you know, imagine, like, with water lines, right? You're not going to have multiple water pipes going to your house. You're going to have one water pipe. Now, where you can make the difference is, where does that pipe go to? And you could have a switching station somewhere, potentially. But the pipes itself, the infrastructure, that's all considered public and, you know, and more utility type of stuff. And go ahead.
Yeah, it's, so one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, Title II effectively doesn't, like you said, you're exactly right. It reclassifies it as a utility. And specifically what it does is it allows the FCC to regulate it. At this point, the FCC can't actually regulate these companies. They've tried. They've been sued. And judges have all said, no, you can't regulate them. You can only regulate utilities and certain, you know, and natural resources like spectrum. But you can't actually regulate the internet companies. They're not a public utility. So basically, the president has given them support in the idea of said, well, then call them a utility so you can regulate them. Part of the power of regulating utilities is the ability to price fix. You know, gas companies can't just charge whatever they want. Generally speaking, occasionally when that sort of regulation goes away, then companies can start charging whatever they want. And they might just happen to turn off power plants and cause rolling blackouts, allowing them to jack up prices. And then, you know, which is effectively what Enron was doing to make all their change before they went completely belly up. What you end up with is this idea that there's a Title II comes with a tremendous number of strings attached. But in America, instead of having the government build power plants or the government build telephone wires or the government build water stations, we have private companies build them, and then the government kind of repurposes them as, well, this is the government's now. And so but it allows more of the profits to go to these different companies. Whereas like in Japan and in Korea and a lot of these companies where they have really, really fast internet, the company or the government lays down all the landlines. And then what they do is they lease the landlines to the private companies who all compete in the open market. Then they basically right. They're acting as the middleman. So Comcast's argument is that, well, because there's no middleman, because we're not the middleman, we're actually the ones building the fiber, we make tons of profit, but we also we're selling it directly to you, so we're costing you less in the long run and we're giving you the best possible service. Which that's the part that's demonstrably not true. The other big problem that we've run into is that a lot of these Comcast and Verizon and WB and everybody else who's built up the landline system has argued that one of the things that they need to do is in order to justify these massive capital expenditures, they need a guarantee that people will use their infrastructure. So what they've done is they've gone to, you know, local areas and basically said, look, allow us to basically have a monopoly on this area and we'll bring this service to your area. And so there's all these legalized monopolies or at best a duopoly where, you know, there's very, very...
Yeah,
very
well, what you got is you got a cable company and then you have the, what's the dial one?
Telephone.
No, it's, what's their name? I already forgot it. Used to be Quest. Now they're that other company.
I don't know.
It's the one that goes to the phone lines. What is
I
that called? You have cable internet.
DSL?
DSL, thank you. And like usually you'll have those two. And the DSL runs through the existing network, you know, through your phone line. And then and then you have cable, and usually that's the two that you have.
Right. And the problem that happens is that, you know, because there's very little competition in the market, then all of a sudden they're able if they want to, they can exercise whatever lack of net neutrality things that they want, and they can't be regulated or stopped if they're abusing that monopoly. And what's crazy is that in, you know, Japan and Korea don't have any net neutrality rules. It all works on the same principles because there's so much competition amongst providers that nobody dares do that because you can just switch. The problem that we've run into is that because there are these monopolies, we don't have the power to switch. We can't just get a different provider. No, if they decide to do that, we're stuck with that as the answer.
That's kind of what the government would have to do, right? They'd have to, and that's essentially, it sounds like what Obama was saying is, you know, in a way you go, we're going to take this over. Thank you very much. It's kind of a eminent domain type of action. And you go, we understand that you built all of that. We thank you. We're now going to run it. If you want to pipe your data and offer the service and compete with others for it, totally cool. We'll do the building for you. Oh yeah, PS, we're gonna charge you a little bit every month so that we can get funds to make capital improvements.
I'm gonna be totally honest. I actually don't think that's a horrible use we try to leave politics out of this, but in general, but my personal opinion is I tend to be very, you know, I tend to be on the smaller side of government, but the government has a purpose. It's supposed to do certain things. And one of the big things is infrastructure, just like roads, just like water, just like those things that it does build. It's supposed to be about building that and at a highly subsidized rate to make it cheaper for everybody.
Right. I mean, schools, that's the example. Whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's things the that whole they, point. There's a public good, yeah. The government should be involved with.
Yeah, and I realize that a lot of your like hardcore libertarians will sit there and say, no, there's always waste, so it will always be more expensive if the government builds roads. But
which, by the way, is more commentary on the government's efficiency rather than the principle. But that's
right, and I think the government can
it's true.
Build.
It's a reality that you have to deal with. That's what I meant to say.
Exactly. I still think that you couldn't, I think that there are complications with the idea of all roads being toll roads. I think that wouldn't work as well as we really want it to. And because otherwise, why is it that every government it's the standard in the entire world? Everybody does that with
the dude, not Singapore. And it's amazing.
And I don't know. You're right. Singapore is such a weird place. I mean, it's almost impossible to it's a despot. They're, I probably shouldn't be saying this because I'm going to have to go there soon. But they're, it's a dictatorship and it's a government controlled. I don't know. That's a weird case. You can't look at it purely. But yeah, you're right. Everything's a toll road. But the toll road system is designed to prevent traffic at certain time of days. It's about regulating traffic flow. Whereas, every other country that's trying to get as much traffic everywhere as it possibly can, you open up you just open up all the lanes and you let as many people get on as possible. I think there's definitely risk in having the government take over because you're back to one organization sort of being the top down. But we've managed to keep all our roads open and free. I'm pretty sure we can do that, allowing, not picking winners and losers in the whole spectrum thing. And I just not forcing companies into rent sinking, but that I think at this point we are in between a rock and a hard place because ideally, you wouldn't have these local monopolies and you'd just be a tremendous amount of competition and then you wouldn't need any regulation, just market competition would allow that to happen, but we didn't do it that way. We decided to give all these local monopolies, and now we're in this place of either the government takes it over completely.
I don't think we realized A, how popular it was going to be, and B, how expensive it was going to be to get the speeds that people want.
The one concern that I have is that with the Title II and making them that, is that if it becomes a they can do what AT&T is doing, which is they've decided to, they've been announcing gigabyte Ethernet in all these different cities are going to bring it to. And this week, after this whole discussion, they said, we're stopping. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to take our ball and go home because they basically said, until we know what until we can have some sort of a guess on what the return on our investment is going to be, and so we can, justify how much money we're putting in or not, which requires us to know what regulations we're dealing with, we're not going to keep investing, which is actually a reasonable response, but it's definitely designed to push the conversation one way, which is for them to say they're trying to convince people that government regulation will mean slower internet. That's what they're trying to say with this, as I don't know. That actually bothers me more than anything but at the same time, it's like, if you don't know what regulations you're going to deal with, if you don't know if things are going to be, taken over by the government relatively soon, you don't know how to invest. And so it's just so complicated.
It's one of those where, I didn't know that was AT&T's response. But that is just the classic of, you don't want to try to work it out. You're gonna go take your ball and go home. You're gonna try to hold us hostage. It's like the executives don't watch movies and realize that people don't like that kind of response, and that it's actually not gonna work out well for them in the end.
I think they think they're so powerful it doesn't matter. They've got all the senators and representatives bought off that they need, in their opinion, and it'll go their way. And Tom Wheeler is the one thing that stands between us and, you know, and...
Yeah, dude, that guy's got a job. I don't feel bad.
Yeah,
I would not want that job.
This is my one concern. He was the lead lobbyist for AT&T and Verizon up until... Or Comcast and Verizon up until he got, you know, appointed as the chairman of the FCC. So it's not like, you know, I mean, and it doesn't... That doesn't necessarily mean... He's a technocrat, and it's hard to be... It's hard to appoint anybody who's qualified to be in that position that doesn't have strong financial commitments with the people he's trying to regulate. But, you know, it doesn't mean that he can't be a good and balanced judge of that. But the idea that he's fair and unbiased is verges on incredulous. Oh. So it's just so complicated, and that's the problem. I do think that just a sweeping declaration of Title II is a little bit hasty. I have the feeling that Obama was given permission, not a permission, but he and his team decided that it was a good time to do it because it gives certain political cover to the FCC to do other things. Because what it'll allow them to do is they'll allow them to go to Comcast and go to these guys and say, well, you know, we'd like to, we need this. And Title II is on the table now. And so now what it allows them to do is to use that as a lever to rein in these guys without actually ever pulling it. I think my personal opinion is I think that's what we saw happen. And it was an okay time to pull that card because as our author wrote, you know, at this point, it doesn't matter. They can't politically get it done any other way. So, like, they had the ability. Now they don't. They can't just pass a law. Right. But it gives Tom Wheeler a political lever, and it is going to actually prevent, even though it'll never happen. It won't be, you know, Title II won't be declared, which is, you know, for better or for worse, you know, you really got to. You know, I have a feeling that really, really smart people who really, really understand what's going on are actually in a big enough of a position, and there's enough attention being paid to it that although nobody's going to actually be happy, a pretty good solution is going to shake out of this. Because I get the gut that, you know,
dude, you're so optimistic. I love it.
I know, I just get the feeling that the government does two things really well, as the old saying goes, nothing and overreact. And it actually seems like there's a certain amount of, you know, consideration and trying to keep it as stay as uninvolved as possible while making sure that abuses don't go on. And, you know, that they can only go so far down that road before they declare Title II, but they do really they are really trying to, quote, not overreact, which you know, I appreciate as a concerned citizen. So I know it's crazy. This is not normally the thing I'm optimistic about. Normally I'm just like, oh, it all's terrible. but
sorry, I like it.
So.
All right, cool, man. So we're going to see where this goes. Probably nowhere, but, you know, just an interesting little dust-up this week where everyone got involved and some people said some pretty stupid things. I actually think Comcast was one of the more measured ones.
Yeah, it's true. They're pretty good at what they do, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you do got to sit there and go, man, there's a reason why they're big. They're not idiots. We may not like it, but... They're good at what they do.
I don't like them. Speaking of giant organizations making good decisions, So Microsoft made a brilliant decision this week, in my humble opinion.
They made a couple brilliant ones, but which one do they do?
in particular. So we've talked a lot about the .NET platform in months and years past on the show because I'm kind of
you
a
got
big
a crush
fan.
Crush on it, yeah.
I know. Well, my thing is that I've got a crush on Java. I really like the idea of this, the portability of a computer, and it's just because it's like you study how a computer works, and you got the operating system that has certain things that it can do naturally, and so you write a program that takes advantage of all these, and it builds it up, right? But it has to be built for that particular operating system, that particular computer, in order to work properly. Well, so these guys come around with Java, and they design what they call the virtual machine, which is to say it's a computer that uses – it's built for a specific platform, but it creates kind of this interface of it will do all those – it will do something a certain way. And so if you build two different virtual machines, one for Windows, one for OS X, and one for Linux, and then they all – but, you know, like the operating facing side is different on everything. But the program facing side, the side that actually executes the program, it does it the exact same way on every platform, which is really cool. And the whole idea with Java was that there'd be one language, multiple virtual machines, and so if you wrote a program, it would work the same on every different platform, which is really cool. And then Microsoft decided to take that one step further, and they are sort of in an inverse direction. They decided to build the .NET platform. But the whole deal was it was only going to work on Windows stuff, but it would work on Windows Phone, it would work on Windows 8, Windows 7. And so, but the really neat part was there was multiple languages that you could use. You could use Visual Basic or C++ or C# or whatever. And they actually have these like open databases of like basically there are like 20 different languages that will all work on this virtual machine, and then this virtual machine can jump onto any Windows platform. Very, very cool as long as you're on Windows. But right, it had limited use as compared to Java, and it was never a direct competitor to Java. Well, as of this week, it just smashed Java in the face.
Boom!
Which is really, really cool. Basically, what they did was they said, we are going to build a operating system, or we're going to build a virtual machine for OS X and Linux, which is huge. So basically what that means is that anybody who's been programming in Visual Basic for the last couple of years and has been building these cool apps that can do cool things, but they only work on Windows machines, now they'll work on OS X. They'll work on Linux. I mean, that is such a big deal. I can't even stand it, especially since the primary programming languages for Visual Basic are C# and Visual Basic, to Windows programming languages. Sasha basically, he came out this week and actually on Monday before they made the announcement. What's his name? Sasha? Sorry.
I've been up till 4.
He basically came out and said, like, he was comparing himself, his company, to Apple and Google. But his big perspective was that Microsoft is a tool for the productive to produce. It's a development platform. That's, like, his entire perspective. And this is really a big shot in that direction, basically saying developers can freely develop on our platform, and it will work wherever you need it to work, which is really, like, that's huge. That's really, really big. Especially since there's a good chance the thing will now work on pretty much any Android phone, or it's a small skip and a step till it does, because it will work in very much the same way that Java does, which is what Android is a fork of Java, and so it's like that's the hardware. They just opened up the floodgates of what hardware will run apps made for them. So if you're a developer trying to get comfortable with Windows, there's a huge reason to be on that platform now. Very cool. And really a good thing for Microsoft. But then they went one step further, and because the whole thing is up to this point, it's all proprietary, which Java is technically proprietary to Oracle. And, you know, every time Oracle sues Google, it's a big to-do because in general, they kind of leave it alone. They let anybody do whatever with it, whatever they want to do with it. Well, Windows has said, we're going to open source the .NET engine. we're gonna give it to the world. It's like, well, what? normally you guys do this when you're about to kill a product. Does that mean you're about to kill .NET? Like, this is not good. It's kind of, everybody gets like,
it's
everybody
sort
of got worried about it.
It's a new day. I know.
But yeah, like you said, it's a different dude in charge. And then they go, and you're like, this is really cool. This is really, like, this is the direction they're going. This is super exciting. Well, then they took it one step beyond that. They've now taken Visual Studios, which is an incredibly expensive developer suite, a integrated developer environment, aka an IDE. That they've taken that suite and they've decided, we're going to let you have it for free, and you can have it for free for a team of people up to 5. What? So basically, small developers can now for free develop for this platform, just like, I don't know, Android. And they said now bigger developers, people who are, you know, making big pieces of software, yeah, you'll still need to pay, and you'll pay a pretty penny, but the assumption is if you've hired more than 5 engineers, you're making enough money, you can afford to license this platform. And that's when it all of a sudden becomes, all right, we're heading in the right direction. They're basically saying, we are going to allow the small app developers community which kind of like exists in thin margins. We're going to support them. We're going to let them use all of our tools. It's only if you're actually making money that we want our cut. Like, okay, very cool. And then the real kicker is, obviously Microsoft has made a big deal about the Azure suite and their desire to really have that back end be one of their major sources of income over the next couple of years. And basically what they've said is, look,
yeah, like
there's
HP.
All these, yeah, yeah, right, like everybody. They're like, basically, this is our deal. We think we've got a pretty good back end. We've got some pretty cool tools that we are going to continue to charge for. And if you want to use those tools, this is how you plug in. It's super easy. It works on everything. It's free for small groups of developers. Just go for it. It'll be awesome. It'll be fun. And then once you're making money, post it on our servers, and everybody makes that like bandits. And I actually think it's huge. I think it's a really, really, really good move by Microsoft. Especially because from a, I often say they got brilliant engineers and terrible marketers. And they just get all these really cool products and cool technologies and then don't do anything with it. And this is like the first time they're really like, wow, this is exactly what a company like this needed to do to make this product huge. I mean, it's one of those things where, my company, Wednesday. I talked to my boss about it on Thursday. We decided to hire a guy on Thursday, a .NET developer, because of this. Like, it's now, we're now ready. We've had a guy that we've been working with for the past couple of years. He does Visual Basic 6. He does, not .NET. And it was just like, this is what we needed to pull the trigger, because now the infrastructure costs are low enough and it's open enough that it really makes sense for us to move over to this develop. It's something we've known we needed to do for a while, and now it's just like, we're okay, the floodgates are open. We all use Mac products, we all use Mac services, basically, except for the machines that we sell. And now we can do this in earnest. And so it's really exciting. Like it's actually like, it's exciting. I like to root for Microsoft when I can, and they're letting me root for them.
I'm going to dovetail this into my next series as well. I feel like Microsoft is starting to shoot a little straighter, and put that vision together.
Yeah,
and this is one of them, kind of like you talked about, where like, and I think you even mentioned it in one of your things, where, they were essentially like, we've got 3 products that we really care about: Windows, Office 365, and Azure. Outside of that, we're pretty flexible on on what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And I think this is one of those examples where they, you know, they go, by making it open source, yeah, sure, we're helping out the others, but we is going to help out Windows.
Right.
So we're okay with that.
Honestly, and the thing is that, you know, it's like, it's okay. You know, it's necessary, because what it does is it, you know, if you want, because now what happens is if you want the best virtual machine in the world, then the most flexible virtual machine in the world, then you need a platform that you can program with it. And it means that, yeah, because they're not making Visual Basic, or they're not making a Visual Studios for OS X. So you still need a Windows machine in order to write your applications, to write your programs. But now it means that if you've got a office that has Linux computers and OS X computers and Windows all coexisting, now your only option isn't Oracle. Like, your only option isn't Java, which is awesome. That's really cool. And there's actually an alternative, and it's thanks to of all people, Microsoft. it's because the front end, the server side is difficult, the client side is difficult in today's world, because there's so many different options, and the idea that you could build one app and it's going to work on all of your different major PCs is awesome. Now you just have to build one little Android app and one little iOS app to plug into the servers, and it'll all work. Awesome. That's just, I don't know, it's cool. And like you said, it has to do with, where are their priorities? They're getting them straight. That's where they're at. Okay, I don't want to run out of time, so I'm going to shut my mouth.
I would agree. They are getting them straight. So they've officially said, the core products of this company are Windows, Office 365, and Azure. They're from a business model, these are the three big things we're very focused on. Notice Xbox is not in that group, which, as a gamer, you might be like, I'm glad I bought that PlayStation.
You're right.
I thought it was interesting, too. They were like, it may not be the sexiest vision that they've ever had, but it's probably true. I think, like you said earlier, too, it surrounds productivity. When you're ready to do work, we want to be there, and so that's part of that vision. The other thing though they've also done is they very much played on this, we're here, but we also realize that you're not going to work all the time, that you also are going to play, and we'd love for you to have the opportunity to play on our devices. And so they've also unveiled their latest bundle, which it's the work and play bundle, actually, which is kind of funny because there used to be a time when they would not use the word bundle,
right,
for Justice Department reasons, but now they're like, that's cool, we can do it.
Now they're not the dominant computer company in the world, so
yeah. So for what is this, $200 a year? I hope it's a year. $200 a month sounds like a lot, but for $200 you will get Office 365 Home. Mm-hmm. You'll get Skype Unlimited World and Wi-Fi.
Ooh. Okay.
Xbox Live Gold.
Mm.
And an Xbox Music Pass. Boom. Yeah, I love this. It's available from November 10th, so that's a few days ago, through January 4th, or while supplies last. While supplies last?
Right? That's weird.
What does that mean? Until we decide we don't want to do it anymore? It's digital, but whatever.
You own all of those services. How would you possibly run out of supplies?
It's good until we run out of server space. Oh, wait, we make servers. We're good.
Super weird.
Yeah, I know. I was like, huh. All right. So, they're buying into this idea of this whole dual use piece by also saying that. So it's kind of like, yeah, we care about these three products, but we haven't forgotten about the other stuff. And honestly, if we can hook you in on the productivity side, we think we can get you back on the play side as well. So we're going to put all that together and try to lock you in with some bundling.
Yeah.
It's kind of the idea there. I mean, it is fascinating, that's what they're doing. Oh, we'll try to get you to pay all at once. Apple's is more like, we're going to make it so that they all work together.
Yeah.
And once you use our system, you don't want to leave. So it's just interesting looking at the different strategies that they're taking. The other thing that they did this week was they launched the first Lumia that is based on Windows, and it says Microsoft on the back. Nokia no more. So it looks okay. It's a lower end phone, not a flagship. And you know, so they're trying to fill in that section of the market. They're not going to go head to head with the iPhone 6 or Nexus 6 or the Samsung thing.
Whatever. Nobody's buying those anyways.
So you know, they're like, yeah, for a budget phone, it's not bad. But the big deal is it's transitioned to Microsoft.
Man, that's crazy.
Microsoft. Yeah. So that was kind of Microsoft had a big week.
That is. They did. They did have a big week. I'm excited for Microsoft. I like the new trajectory. Google made a kind of a big announcement this week too.
Yeah, what'd they say?
They're getting into music, man. Big time.
Surprise, surprise. Weren't they already there?
Right. It's the craziest thing in the world. They're trying to figure out how to take any market share from Apple, like any would be ideal. And so they've come up with this new service that they're going to highly integrate with YouTube. One of the big justifications for this, and this is something that I keep coming back to, and I think I get, T-Swift's, Taylor Swift's budgeting department is way bigger than mine, so, you know, who am I to criticize? But Google basically came out and said that they've come out with a couple of these new streaming music services, and what they've found is that they've actually sold a lot more music because of it. You're like, but what? And it's just this weird sort of gravitational effect that happens with streaming services. For example, pirates always spend more on music and movies than anybody else.
Yeah.
Me personally, I spend more on music with more access to songs that I want to discover. So, like, you know, and that's just kind of a general purpose, like, you know, I go to concerts and stuff, but also money that I'm, you know, actually just buying the music. Basically, what they said was that Google Music streams increased spending on music after subscription, and there's a, you know, it's a trend, it's happening, and because of that, it means that Google really wants to get more into the streaming music for people, because there's money there. There's a lot of money, and if you could sweep people into it, there's a real advantage, and they got such a giant platform with Android, but to push this out to everybody, there's some serious potential there. So in that context, this week they announced Music Key, and basically what it is it's you now have this additional tab when you go to your YouTube app that says music. And as everybody knows, there's all sorts of YouTube videos that people listen to or watch with music videos and whatnot.
Right.
And, you know, music on YouTube is huge. And it's big enough where it's actually one of the primary sources that tweens get their music, as opposed to, like, Spotify or Pandora stuff, because it gives them huge flexibility. They can pick whatever they song they want, and they can just listen to it and or watch it or whatever. But YouTube's been big into music for a while, but there's no real structure to it, and there's no real financing of it. So they're launching this new service. It's currently in beta, and they're slowly offering it to more people. And basic idea is you pay a subscription for music. You don't have to watch any ads on the apps. When you close the app right now, the music stops. And bummer. But if you're listening to us, if you're watching a music video and you close the app, it'll keep playing in the background, like, you know, any other music app. So it becomes a serious music streaming device. And then, so if you've got a playlist going and you're listening to this, you know, you're watching the video, you close the app, now it keeps playing. Playlist keeps playing. And it basically becomes effectively just as you would expect on something like, Spotify, and which is cool. It's really cool. It, Yeah, it's a crazy strategy for Google. Not a crazy one. I mean, it's actually like kind of it's smart. It's an iterative step. The biggest problem that they're going to run into, and this is the biggest reason why it's still in beta, is because they're not exactly sure what constitutes music.
What?
Yeah. But this totally makes sense when you think about it. One of the big things that they've always struggled with is you're watching a video of you want to learn how to cut a pompadour for your customers and you're a barber. So you go online and you search how to cut a pompadour, and then it goes to some dude in some barbershop and he's got his buddy recording him on his iPhone. And he's just talking to the camera and you get the sounds of zzz, zzz, as they're cutting and doing all the different stuff. But in the background is playing, you know, Shake It Off, for example.
Yeah, something.
Evidently, there's no other music other than Taylor Swift music anymore. The song is like, that one and Back to the Shack by Weezer, I cannot get out of my head. So basically what's going on is they're saying, what does that constitute? Is that a video of barbering? Is that a music video? Like, how they've, you know, one of the things that YouTube does is that if this song isn't something that they have a license to play, then they just automatically, you know, they'll mute it during that period of the song. But if they do have a license to play it and they're allowed to play it, then when an ad gets pushed in front of that video and every time the video plays, that is considered part of the contract of this is whenever music plays on YouTube. And that's what their whole, like, scrubbing algorithms are all about. So the question becomes is, like, how is that treated? Because that's a different contract, different licensing deal than what's going on with, you know, everything else. And, like, it. So it just becomes this or for another example, Justin Bieber, before he was Justin Bieber, was on YouTube singing and dancing to other people's songs. Now, they weren't, you know, he wasn't actually playing other people's songs. He was singing their songs. Is that considered music? Like, who gets paid for that? Where does the licensing go? And so there's just this real sort of like hazy ground that they're using existing contracts, existing deals, existing agreements to sort of, and leveraging it into this bigger service that is actually going to help finance it. And as they move on, but it asks this bigger question of, you know, what do we as a society consider music? Where should this money be going? Who's a creator? Who's an artist? And because YouTube is so collaborative and there's so many contributors, it becomes instantly more complicated. Because you're no longer just negotiating with a couple of, you know, producers, a couple of record houses. You're negotiating with the internet, and you know, as much as you're negotiating with Taylor Swift individually. So
right.
it's really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes, because I do think that's really important in, you know, for the future of how we distribute art in a technological age, and how artists get paid and what that all looks like. And so, you know, I'm pretty heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem. I probably won't get this service, but I'm going to be following it closely. Or not at first, at least. But I'm going to be following it closely because it's really, you know, it's a compelling and interesting problem that they're dealing with. And how that sort of gets sorted out will probably set a standard for anybody who tries to create a, you know, competing service. So it's cool. It's really cool. Looking forward to seeing what happens.
I'm not quite as deep into it as you are, but I agree that there are some interesting questions there that need to be answered that have huge implications.
Yeah.
Just make your own stuff all the time. It's okay, man.
Exactly. Just learn how to play an instrument. You'll be able to do be able to entertain yourself with everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work that way.
That'd be nice, right? No, there's a reason why the Industrial Revolution took off, because we could leverage other people's work and build upon it to create something faster and better.
Exactly. So I got three articles left.
Right. I'm gonna do it. You got less than 10 minutes, man.
Oh, baby. So number one, Sony is going to launch its own internet TV. This event isn't particularly interesting to anybody except me because I own a PlayStation 4, which means I'll be able to easily access it.
Nice.
I know. So, I mean, actually,
so, like, what are they going to show?
So, the deal is it's basically like a Netflix competitor. They're going to try to set up deals with networks and really get those on board. But they're also doing their own content. They got one show. That looks really interesting. It's based off a comic strip. But the idea of it's this guy who used to be a superhero and got his powers taken away, and now he's just a detective and kind of dealing with that. And so
that's
like
horrible.
Yeah. I'm really. It's actually. But the main actor is the guy from District 9. He's in a couple of other movies. I'm a big fan of him as an actor. So I want to see it. I'm
and that's only available on a PlayStation.
So far, they've got a couple of different PlayStation.
I mean, that's the trick, right? Get content that people want to see.
I know.
Sounds like an interesting storyline.
Yeah, and right, it's
because usually it goes the other way.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but you know, for positioning the PlayStation and how to turn it into a big platform, it's interesting. It's sort of like the Blu-ray thing, you know, sell the platforms in order to sell content. But one of the things that I think is interesting about this is this bigger question of, okay, obviously everybody's getting on board. And the question to me is like, you know, okay, I've already got Netflix, but some people have Netflix and Hulu and HBO Go and Showtime and, you know, ESPN and, you know, the Football Network and the MLB Network and the NBA Network. They got everything. And it's to the point where it's like, it's as expensive, if not more expensive than having cable. But worse, there's a lot of duplicates. There's a lot of, well, we already have that show on Netflix, and I also have it on Amazon Prime, and I also have it on this. So it's like, I'm wondering how many of these different services can the market bear? And I'm guessing the answer is not as many as there will ever be. There's going to be a lot more, but it's just sort of that interest. It's interesting to watch these different companies jump on the bandwagon. And the other really fascinating part about this is like we when we look back at our predictions about companies becoming studios, becoming their own, like these hardware software companies saying, hey, we're going to be get into producing entertainment as well, and really taking the power away from somebody like Comcast and NBC, because now there's a lot of competition in the field when it comes to making new TV shows, and that's like finally happening in earnest. Now, we all predicted it was going to be Apple because they got more money than you can shake a stick at, but evidently it's, you know, not them. And one of the reasons why Sony's really compelling is because Sony's already a producer. They make movies, they make music, so it's like they've already got the infrastructure and the know-how to do this sort of thing. So it's cool, it's exciting, but at the same time, it's like, could it, you know, can you have, and do you need a massive market in order to justify it, or does it just need to be another perk to having a PlayStation? I'm interested to see from that perspective where we go.
Yeah, dude, that's crazy. It's kind of Sony, man. It's like they took a 5-year break and now they're back.
Exactly. Yeah. PlayStation 3 wasn't their brightest hour,
and then that was a symptom, really, and of a bigger problem. Like I said, if just overall, you know, I remember like they were doing computers and TVs, and people are still like, oh yeah, you know, Sony TVs are good, but you know, like it just fell off the map. I don't know, but now it's like they realized, oh, check it out, we're not perfect. We need to actually think through these things and make better products like we're known for, and they're doing it.
Yeah, it's cool. It's fun to watch.
It was almost like they did the equivalent of they lost the Blu-ray war, and then like they were like, we're taking our ball and going home.
Yeah.
And no one cared. They went, oh, okay. I guess we'll play the other game. Fine.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because the Blu-ray is still an important technology, but yeah, it just didn't pan out to, you know. Oh. Steve Jobs said, I'm done playing that game. We're going to go all digital content, and then...
Wait, that's right. Blu-ray did work out. It was the Never mind, dude. I take that back. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry.
Well, but even then, I mean, like, I think there's the reality of the fact that, yeah, Blu-ray 1 is the de facto standard, but nobody uses Blu-ray. Like, not really. Like, they expected it to be, you know, every DVD that, or every movie that would be bought for the next decade would be Blu-ray, and that just didn't happen that way. Like, they
were thinking
the disc format,
the Blu-ray was going to be the CD to the cassette, and, you know,
it wasn't.
I know. Turned out downloads and subscriptions was.
Yeah. But there's just, like, you know, the PlayStation was a fumble, and like you said, they lost a lot of space in the TV market, and they just, in a whole, the company's been struggling, and they're finally starting to kind of claw their way back up the old-fashioned way by having better products and better services. So
yeah,
it's cool. It's fun to watch.
I love it.
Next, this is ridiculous. Sharp has demoed a 736 ppi pixels per inch screen.
That's very dense.
Yeah. Well, what's crazy about it is, like, after 500, the eye can't, like, nobody's eye can discern pixels. Like, you know, Apple made a big deal about the 300 ppi, you know, retina display, which is effectively what they say. You can't distinguish pixels at about 8 to 12 inches with standard vision. So, you know, it's effectively pixel-less. But the reality of it is, if you get it closer, you can kind of see the pixels, and there's certain details that get lost even at that resolution. It's not perfect. We have fully moved into, you can't see it without, like, special equipment anymore. Like, it's just, what the heck? And they keep pushing it, like, they keep pushing further and further down that road. Now, granted, this is a small screen that they've made. It's about the size of a smartphone. But the craziness is, it's like a Samsung has got a competing screen, and this is actually the important part of the article, and they're going to put it into a phone soon. What the heck? Who needs that? But that being said, it's kind of cool. It's kind of exciting, and it will be very interesting to see, you know, where that ends. I think at some point, you know, contrast becomes a bigger deal and stuff like that. But we're not to the end of the pixel war, and we're going to keep sliding down that rabbit hole as quick as we can.
That's pretty cool. You know, and then the other implications, it requires more memory, more processor speed, you know, all that stuff to handle the extra data. Your pictures, you'll want them to be better because you'll be able to see that you have the highest quality camera or something like that. Interesting.
So this last article, I think I'm out of time for, unfortunately. So I'm going to leave it on the docket for next week, actually. I think it'll still apply.
Love it.
And it was late enough in the week. I don't mind doing that, so.
Dang. You were kidding when you were like, you got a hard stop.
Yep.
All right. Let's see here. I'm ready. I figured out how to get rid of the dinging.
Nice.
So now I got to turn it all back on. That dinging's back. All right. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us. We genuinely really do appreciate it. My name is James Furlow. My half of a marathon brother is Matthew Furlow. And we will talk next time.